Chapter 20. Berlin. Hitler was serious about seeking an agreement with Britain that would end the war, though he grew convinced that no such thing could be achieved while Churchill was still in power. Britain's attack on the French fleet at Mers el Kebir had proved that beyond doubt. In July, Hitler met with his deputy, Rudolf Hess, and told him of his frustration, conveying his wish that Hess find a way of engineering the removal of Churchill as Prime Minister so as to clear a path for negotiations with a presumably more pliable successor. As Hess saw it, Hitler was assigning him the great mandate of securing peace in the West. To Hess, it was a welcome honour. For a time, he had been closer to Hitler than any other party member. For 8 years, he served as Hitler's private secretary, and following the abortive Nazi putsch of 1923, was incarcerated with Hitler at Landsberg prison, where Hitler began writing Mein Kampf. Hess typed the manuscript. Hess understood that a central tenet of Hitler's geopolitical strategy, set out in the book, was the importance of peace with Britain, and he knew how strongly Hitler believed that, in the prior war, Germany had made a fatal mistake in provoking Britain to fight. Hess considered himself so much in tune with Hitler that he could execute his will without being commanded to do so. Hess hated Jews and orchestrated many restrictions on Jewish life. He cast himself as the embodiment of the Nazi spirit and made himself responsible for perpetuating national adoration of Hitler and ensuring party purity. But with the advent of war, Hess began to lose prominence, and men like Hermann Göring began to ascend. To have Hitler now assign so important an undertaking must certainly have reassured Hess. There was little time, however. With France now fallen, Britain must either agree to stand down or face extinction. One way or another, Churchill had to be removed from office. In his conversation with Hess, Hitler expressed his frustration at England's intransigence in a way that, given events soon to occur, would seem at least superficially prophetic. "What more can I do?" Hitler asked. "I can't fly over there and beg on bended knee." The attack at Mers el Kebir had indeed taken Nazi leaders by surprise, but Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels now saw that the incident opened a new path for waging Germany's propaganda war against Britain. At his morning meeting on July 4th, he told his lieutenants to use the incident to show that, once again, France was bearing the brunt of the war, even as Britain claimed that the attack was in France's interest. "Here," he told the group, "Britain has really revealed herself without her mask." All efforts were to be made to continue stoking hatred of Britain, and of Churchill in particular, but not to the point of sparking popular demand for an all-out attack. Goebbels knew that Hitler remained ambivalent about invasion and still favoured a negotiated resolution. "It is therefore necessary to mark time, since we cannot anticipate any decisions by the Führer," Goebbels said. "The mood, as far as possible, must be kept on the boil until the Führer himself has spoken." And Hitler did plan to speak soon, as Goebbels knew. Anticipating his remarks, Goebbels, at a meeting 2 days later, emphasized that for the time being the ministry's propaganda should promote the idea that the English should be given one last chance of getting off comparatively slightly. Goebbels believed that Hitler's coming speech could alter the course of the war, possibly even end it, and, failing that, would at least offer a rich new avenue for igniting public hatred of Churchill. At 10 Downing Street that week, anxiety intensified as to whether the French might yet declare war against England, and whether Germany would now invade. On July 3rd, a report by the chiefs of staff warned that major operations against this country, either by invasion and or heavy air attack, may commence any day from now onwards. It listed ominous developments detected by reconnaissance and intelligence sources, among them certain secret sources, a reference undoubtedly to Bletchley Park. In Norway, German forces were requisitioning and arming vessels. The country had 800 fishing boats. The Luftwaffe was transferring troop-carrying aircraft to its first-line air bases. The German Navy held an amphibious landing exercise on the Baltic coast, and two regiments of parachute troops moved to Belgium. Perhaps most ominous, information from a most reliable source is to the effect that the Germans will hold a parade of their armed forces in Paris sometime after 10th July. Hitler, it seemed, considered victory to be certain. I have the impression, John Colville wrote, that Germany is collecting herself for a great spring, and it is an uncomfortable impression. Fueling his concerns was a German action that had taken place a few days earlier, on the day of Churchill's speech about the battle at Merselkebir. 20 German dive bombers had attacked targets on the Isle of Portland, which juts into the channel off England's south coast. They escaped without interception by the RAF. A bad lookout for the future, if this can be done with impunity in broad daylight, Colville wrote. Chapter 21. Champagne and Garbo. On Wednesday, July 10th, Gay Margesson visited Colville in London. They saw the Strauss operetta Die Fledermaus, performed in English. Most of the audience loved the humour. Colville and Gay did not, and left in the middle of the third act. In the intervals, he wrote in his diary, Gay insisted on talking politics, about which she is as ignorant as she is prejudiced, and indulging in recriminations of Chamberlain and his government. For the first time since I have known her, I found her definitely tedious and puerile. As Colville himself admitted, by looking for faults in Gay, he hoped to ease the hurt of her steadfast unwillingness to return his affections. But he could not help it. He was still in love. They moved on to the Café de Paris, a popular nightclub, and there her charms and real lovableness reasserted themselves, and I forgot the somewhat unpleasant impression I had been forming. They talked, drank champagne, and danced. An impersonator did renditions of Ingrid Bergman and Greta Garbo. Colville was back in his own bed, alone, at 2 a.m., content in the belief that Gay might be warming to him at last. Chapter 22. Have we sunk so low? England braced for invasion. Troops piled sandbags and built machine gun nests near the Palace of Westminster, home to Parliament and Big Ben. In Parliament Square, a small fortified redoubt, a pillbox, was disguised as a W.H. Smith book kiosk. Sandbags and guns adorned the grounds of Buckingham Palace, where the masses of tulips in the palace gardens were, according to New Yorker writer Molly Panter Downs, exactly the colour of blood. The Queen began taking lessons in how to shoot a revolver. Yes, she said, I shall not go down like the others. In Hyde Park, soldiers dug anti-tank trenches and erected obstacles to prevent German gliders from landing troops in the heart of London. A government pamphlet on how to behave during an invasion warned citizens to stay in their homes and not attempt to run, because if you run away, you will be machine-gunned from the air, as were civilians in Holland and Belgium. Every day, more and more of the English public bore direct witness to the war as German bombers, accompanied by masses of fighters, extended their forays deeper and deeper into the realm. Just that week, a lone bomber attacked Aberdeen, Scotland, dropping 10 bombs that killed 35 people, yet never triggered an air raid alert. The same night, other bombers struck Cardiff, Tyneside, and near Glasgow. 40 dive bombers, with fighter escorts, attacked the harbour at Dover. Bombs and incendiaries fell on Avonmouth, Colchester, Brighton, Hove, and the Isle of Sheppey. Churchill made sure that Roosevelt knew about all of them. By now, the Foreign Office was dispatching daily telegrams to the President on the war situation, matter-of-fact accountings of actions in all theatres, delivered through Britain's ambassador in Washington. These had a dual purpose, to keep the President up to date, and, more importantly, to make sure that Roosevelt understood that Britain's need for American aid was real and urgent. Often the German sorties were met by British fighters, which gave the civilians below a close-up look at aerial warfare. The RAF's fighter pilots were fast becoming the heroes of the age, as were their counterparts in RAF Bomber Command. Established on April 1, 1918, in the waning months of the prior war, the RAF consolidated disparate air units operated by the Army and Navy in order to better defend against aerial attack. It was now acknowledged to be the first line of defence against Germany. To Mary Churchill and her friend Judy Montagu, the pilots were gods. The two girls were spending the high summer together at Judy's country home, Breckles Hall in Norfolk, where nearly every afternoon they flirted with bomber crews from nearby air bases. In the evening they attended squadron dances, which Mary described as very jolly and noisy and pretty drunken affairs, with sometimes an undercurrent of tension, especially if planes had failed to return. They made special friends, as Mary put it, and Judy invited them back to the house to play tennis, swim, lark about, indulge in snogging sessions in the hayloft, or just sit in the garden gossiping. The men were, for the most part, in their 20s, middle class, unmarried. Mary found them charming. She delighted in the occasions in which the pilots engaged in bouts of beating up, flying over breckles at treetop level. On one occasion, crews from the nearby base at Watton gave us the most superb aerial beating up that anyone could possibly conceive, Mary wrote in her diary. A flight of Blenheims appeared, and one after another swooped down to within 25 or 30 feet of the ground. We all nearly passed out with excitement. Every day these same pilots took part in life-or-death sorties that, as far as Churchill was concerned, would determine the fate of the British Empire. Civilians watched air battles unfold from the safety of their gardens, or while strolling village streets and picnicking in bucolic meadows, as circular contrails filled the sky above. At dusk, these caught the last of the day's sunlight and turned a luminescent amber. At dawn, they became mother-of-pearl spirals. Aircraft crashed into pastures and forests. Pilots tumbled from cockpits and drifted to earth. On July 14th, a mobile BBC radio team stationed itself on the Dover Cliffs in hopes of capturing an aerial battle as it occurred, and gave its listeners an account that for some proved too enthusiastic. The BBC announcer, Charles Gardner, turned the battle into a blow-by-blow account that had more in common with a soccer commentary than a report on a mortal encounter over the Channel. This struck many listeners as unseemly. A London woman wrote to the News Chronicle, "Have we really sunk so low that this sort of thing can be treated as a sporting event? With cries of glee, we were told to listen for the machine gunning. We were asked to visualize a pilot, hampered by his parachute, struggling in the water." She warned, with a degree of prescience, "If this sort of thing is allowed to go unchecked, we shall soon have microphones installed in any available front line, with squared diagrams printed in the Radio Times to help us follow the action." Mass observation diarist Olivia Cockett also found it repellent. "It shouldn't be allowed," she insisted. "It makes play and sport of agonies, not to help people bear them, but to pander to the basest, crudest, most to be wiped out feelings of cruel violence." What made it worse, one woman told a Home Intelligence survey taker, was the announcer's callous Oxford accent. But a Home Intelligence report released the next day, July 15th, after a quick poll of 300 Londoners, stated that a considerable majority spoke enthusiastically of the broadcast. New Yorker writer Panta Downs suspected that most listeners reveled in the drama. She wrote in her diary, "The majority of decent citizens, possibly less squeamish, sat by their radios, hanging on to their seats and cheering." What especially heartened the public was that the RAF appeared consistently to best the Luftwaffe. In the battle off Dover, as Churchill told Roosevelt in one of the Foreign Office's daily telegraphic updates, the Germans suffered 6 confirmed losses, 3 fighters, 3 bombers. The British lost a single Hurricane. The July 15th Home Intelligence report found that for the public watching from below, the bringing down of raiders has a psychological effect immensely greater than the military advantage gained. Churchill himself found it all thrilling. "After all," he told an interviewer with the Chicago Daily News later that week, "what more glorious thing can a spirited young man experience than meeting an opponent at 400 miles an hour, with 1,200 or 1,500 horsepower in his hands and unlimited offensive power? It is the most splendid form of hunting conceivable." In July, with his aborted resignation forgiven and forgotten, Lord Beaverbrook returned with gusto to the production of fighters. He built planes at a furious pace and made enemies just as fast, but he also became the adored son of England. Though a brigand in the view of his antagonists, Lord Beaverbrook had a subtle grasp of human nature and was adept at marshalling workers and the public to his cause. Case in point was his Spitfire Fund. Without prompting by him or the Air Ministry, The citizens of Jamaica, a British colony until 1962, contributed money for the building of a bomber and sent it to Beaverbrook via the island's major newspaper, the Daily Gleaner. This tickled Beaverbrook, who made sure that the gift and his telegram of thanks got widespread attention. Soon other gifts began to arrive, from locales as far away as America and Ceylon, and once again Beaverbrook sent thank you telegrams and made sure the messages got national coverage. Soon it occurred to him that this civic generosity could be harnessed not just to generate much-needed cash to build airplanes, but also to boost engagement with the war effort among the public, and, importantly, among workers in his aircraft plants, whom he believed to be plagued by a persistent lack of drive. He never issued a direct public plea for contributions. Instead, he made a deliberate show of acknowledging those that arrived. When donations reached a certain level, the contributors could choose to name a specific fighter. A richer total allowed the donors to name a bomber. The naming of a whole squadron became the goal, recalled David Farrer, one of Beaverbrook's secretaries. Soon the BBC began announcing the names of contributors on the air during its nightly news broadcasts. At first, Beaverbrook wrote a personal letter to every donor. But when this became too big an obligation, he directed his secretaries to choose the gifts most worthy of attention, whether because of the amount or the story behind the gift. A child giving up a few pence was as likely to get a letter as was a rich industrialist. A torrent of money began to flow toward the Ministry of Aircraft Production, mostly in small amounts, and accumulated in what the donors themselves began calling Spitfire Fund, owing to their preference for the fighter that had become the icon of the air war, even though the RAF had more Hurricanes than Spitfires. Although Beaverbrook's detractors dismissed the fund as just another of his stunts, in fact, it soon began drawing contributions at a rate of £1 million per month, about $64 million today. By May 1941, the total collected would reach £13 million, $832 million, at which point, wrote Farrer, practically every big town in Britain had its name on an aircraft. The fund had only a marginal effect on the overall production of fighters and bombers, but Beaverbrook saw a much greater value in its spiritual influence. To countless men and women, Secretary Farrer wrote, he made easy the way to a more personal interest in the war and to an enthusiastic contribution to its waging. Beaverbrook found other means of achieving this heightened engagement as well, these just as oblique. Like Churchill, he recognized the power of symbols. He sent RAF pilots to factories to establish a direct connection between the work of building airplanes and the men who flew them. He insisted that these be actual fighting pilots, with wings on their uniforms, not merely RAF officials paroled briefly from their desks. He also ordered that the husks of downed German planes be displayed around the country, and in such a way that the public would not suspect the hand of the Minister of Aircraft Production. He saw great benefit in having flatbed trucks carry the downed aircraft through bombed-out cities. This circus, as he called it, was always well received, but especially so in the most heavily mauled locales. The people appeared very pleased to see the aircraft, Beaverbrook told Churchill, and the circus had a great effect. When complaints arrived from farmers, village elders and golf course operators about German aircraft on their fields, squares and greens, Beaverbrook resolved to take his time having the planes removed, the opposite of the haste with which he recovered salvageable RAF fighters. After a complaint from one golf course, he ordered that the German plane be left where it was. It will do the players good to see the crashed machine, he told his publicity man. It will make them conscious of the battle. Outraged by Churchill's resistance and rhetoric, Hitler ordered the very thing Britain had feared, a full-on assault from the sea. Until now, there had been no concrete plan for an invasion of England, scientific or otherwise. On Tuesday, July 16th, he issued Directive Number 16, entitled On Preparations for a Landing Operation Against England, and codenamed the plan Seelöwe, or Sea Lion. Since England, in spite of her hopeless military situation, shows no signs of being ready to come to an understanding, the directive began, I have decided to prepare a landing operation against England and, if necessary, to carry it out. He anticipated a vast seaborne attack, The landing will be in the form of a surprise crossing on a wide front from about Ramsgate to the area west of the Isle of Wight. This encompassed a swath of English coastline that included beaches on the Strait of Dover, the narrowest part of the English Channel. His commanders envisioned as many as 1,600 vessels delivering a first wave of 100,000 men. All planning and preparation for Sea Lion were to be completed by mid-August, Hitler wrote. He identified objectives that had to be achieved before an invasion could begin. Foremost among them, the English Air Force must be so reduced morally and physically that it is unable to deliver any significant attack against the German crossing. Chapter 23. What's in a Name? A small but pressing crisis abruptly arose in the Churchill family. By July, Pamela Churchill was convinced that her baby was going to be a boy, and she set her heart on naming the child Winston Spencer Churchill, after the Prime Minister. But that same month, the Duchess of Marlborough, whose husband was a cousin of Churchill's, gave birth to a boy and claimed the full name for her son. Pamela was crushed and angry. She went to Churchill in tears and pleaded with him to do something. He agreed that the name was rightfully his to bestow, and that it would be more appropriate to give it to a grandson than a nephew. He called the Duchess and told her bluntly that the name was his, and it was to be given to Pamela's new son. The Duchess protested that Pamela's child had not even been born yet. Obviously there was no certainty that it would be a boy. "Of course it will," Churchill snapped. "And if it isn't this time, it will be next time." The Duke and Duchess renamed their son Charles. Chapter 24. The Tyrant's Appeal. On Friday, July 19th, Hitler strode to the rostrum of the Kroll Opera House in Berlin to address the Reichstag, Germany's legislature, which had been meeting in that building ever since the eponymous 1933 fire that had made the body's official home unusable. On the dais, near Hitler, sat Luftwaffe Chief Göring, large and merry, like a happy child playing with his toys on Christmas morning, wrote correspondent William Scheirer, who witnessed the speech. In an aside, Scheirer added, "Only how deadly that some of the toys he plays with, besides the electric train in the attic of Karinhall, happened to be Stuka bombers." Göring and a dozen generals were to receive their own promotions that night, the generals to the rank of Field Marshal, and Göring, already a Field Marshal, to the newly created rank of Reichsmarschall. Hitler knew his man. He understood Göring's need for special attention and gleaming medals. Earlier that Friday, Propaganda Minister Joseph Goebbels had centered his regular morning meeting on the speech and its potential effect, according to minutes of the session. He cautioned that foreign reaction would likely not reach full flower for 2 or 3 days, but that it was certain to polarize public opinion within Britain, even to the point of forcing Churchill's resignation. The meeting minutes stated, "The minister emphasizes that Britain's fate will be decided this evening." As Hitler began speaking, Scheirer, seated in the audience, was struck anew by his rhetorical skills. "So wonderful an actor," Scheirer wrote in his diary, "so magnificent a handler of the German mind." He marveled at how Hitler managed to cast himself as both conqueror and humble supplicant for peace. He noticed, too, that Hitler spoke in a lower register than was typical, and without his usual histrionics. He used his body to underscore and amplify the thoughts he sought to convey, cocking his head to impart irony, moving with a cobra's grace. What especially caught Scheirer's attention was the way Hitler moved his hands. Tonight, he used those hands beautifully, seemed to express himself almost as much with his hands and the sway of his body as he did with his words and the use of his voice. First, Hitler ran through the history of the war thus far, laying the blame for it on Jews, Freemasons, and Anglo-French warmongers, foremost among them Churchill. "I feel a deep disgust for this type of unscrupulous politician who wrecks entire nations and states," Hitler said. He framed the war as a quest to restore Germany's honor and rescue the nation from the oppression of the Treaty of Versailles. He congratulated his army and generals, commending many by name, singling out as well Rudolf Hess, his official deputy, Heinrich Himmler, chief of Hitler's protective force, the SS, Josef Goebbels, and Goering, clearly his favourite among the four, to whom he devoted several minutes of fulsome praise. Throughout Hitler's speech, Scheirer observed, Goering leaned over his desk chewing his pencil and scribbling out in large, scrawly letters the text of his remarks which he would make after Hitler finished. He chewed on his pencil and frowned and scribbled like a schoolboy over a composition that has got to be in by the time the class has ended. At intervals, Goering grinned and applauded, thudding his big hands together with exaggerated force. Hitler announced Goering's promotion and handed him a box containing the requisite new insignia for his uniform. Goering opened the box, peeked in, then went back to chewing his pencil. His boyish pride and satisfaction was almost touching, old murderer that he is, Scheirer wrote. Hitler turned to the future. He proclaimed his army to be at its most powerful and promised to respond to British air raids on Germany in a manner that would bring unending suffering and misery to England, though probably not to Churchill himself, he said, for he no doubt will already be in Canada, where the money and the children of those principally interested in the war already have been sent. For millions of other persons, great suffering will begin. Now came the portion of the speech that Goebbels believed would determine Britain's fate. Mr. Churchill, Hitler said, for once believe me when I predict a great empire will be destroyed, an empire that it was never my intention to destroy or even to harm. The only possible result of the war, he warned, was the annihilation of either Germany or Britain. Churchill may believe this will be Germany, he said. I know it will be Britain. With his hands and body he conveyed with clarity that this was no mere threat. In this hour I feel it to be my duty before my own conscience to appeal once more to reason and common sense in Great Britain as much as elsewhere. I consider myself in a position to make this appeal, since I am not the vanquished begging favours, but the victor speaking in the name of reason. Abruptly the conqueror gave way to the humble Führer. I can see no reason why this war must go on, he said. I am grieved to think of the sacrifices it will claim. I should like to avert them. Overhead, German ace Adolf Galland and his squadron flew a protective screen above Berlin's Opera House to guard against RAF bombers, a choice assignment meant to honour their performance in the French campaign. Though only 28 years old, Galland was by now a seasoned combat pilot, commander of his own fighter group. Big-eared, dark, with a black moustache and a broad smile, he had none of the Nordic iciness that the Nazi party held dear, nor was he an ardent believer in party ideology. He cut a rakish figure, often wearing his officer's cap cocked at an angle. Just the day before the speech, he had been promoted to the rank of major and awarded his third Knight's Cross for shooting down 17 aircraft and providing effective support for Germany's ground forces. By the time his commander, Albert Kesselring, physically presented the award, however, Galland's total of verified kills had risen to 30. His role as aerial guardian during Hitler's speech was not wholly honorific, he wrote later. One bomb on the Kroll Opera House would actually have eliminated the entire German high command at one fell swoop, so the precaution seemed well justified. Galland's journey to this moment embodied the broader story of the creation and flowering of the Luftwaffe as a whole. Galland became obsessed with aviation early in his youth, his imagination fired by post-war accounts of the aerial exploits of Baron von Richthofen. At age 17, he began flying gliders. His father pressed him to join the army, but Galland just wanted to fly and sought a way of making a living in the air. What he most wanted was to fly powered aircraft. He saw only one path, to become a pilot with Germany's newly founded airline, Deutsche Lufthansa, soon to be known simply as Lufthansa. But every other young flying enthusiast seemed also to share this ambition. Galland's application to the German airline pilot school was one of 20,000, from which the school chose 100 candidates. Only 20 made the final cut, Galland among them. By the end of 1932, he had earned a preliminary flying certificate. Now things took an unexpected turn. Galland and four other students received orders to report to a flying school in Berlin, where they were invited to join a secret course in flying military aircraft. Secret because Hitler at this time was beginning his campaign to rearm Germany in defiance of the Treaty of Versailles, which had ended the Great War. All five accepted the offer. They travelled in civilian clothes to an airfield near Munich, where they attended lectures on tactics and spent 25 hours flying old biplanes, learning such techniques as how to fly in formation and strafe targets on the ground. The high point, Gallant recalled, was a visit from Hermann Göring, who had embarked secretly on building a new air force. After a brief stint as a co-pilot on a commercial airliner, Gallant, in December 1933, was summoned back to Berlin and invited to join Göring's still secret force, the Luftwaffe. The following fall, he was posted to its first fighter unit. When the Air Force began flying combat missions in Spain's Civil War on behalf of General Francisco Franco's nationalist forces, and pilots came back with stories that depicted a life of romance and derring do, Gallant volunteered. He soon found himself aboard a tramp steamer bound for Spain, along with 370 other Luftwaffe members, all again dressed in civilian clothing and carrying papers that indicated they were civilians. In Spain, Gallant was disappointed to find himself placed in charge of a fighter group equipped with biplanes, while his fellow pilots flew the latest fighter, the Messerschmitt ME-109. The Luftwaffe's Spanish experience taught many valuable lessons about aerial warfare, but it also lodged a misconception in the minds of Göring and other senior officers. The bombers Germany deployed in Spain happened to be faster than the antiquated enemy fighters they encountered, and this conjured a wishful conviction early on that bombers did not require fighter escorts. Gallant went on to participate in each of Hitler's lightning invasions, and at last was assigned to a fighter group that flew the newest fighters. Soon he had his first encounters with British RAF pilots flying the latest Hurricanes and Spitfires. He immediately understood that, from this point onward, he would be facing an opponent unlike any he had encountered thus far. The kind of combat he claimed to wish for, when each relentless aerial combat was a question of you or me. The first-line fighter planes of both sides were more or less evenly matched, though each had attributes that gave it an advantage under particular conditions. Britain's Spitfires and Hurricanes were more heavily armed and more manoeuvrable, but the German Messerschmitt ME-109 performed better at higher altitudes and carried more protective armour. The Spitfire had 8 machine guns, the ME-109 only 2, but it also had 2 cannons that fired exploding shells. All 3 fighters were mono-wing, single-engine planes, capable of flying at unheard-of speeds, well over 300 miles an hour. But all had the same limitation. Their fuel capacity gave them only about 90 minutes of flying time, barely enough to get to London and back. Overall, the Messerschmitt was considered to be the superior aircraft, but a more important advantage was the fact that German pilots, like Gallant, had far more experience with aerial combat. The average age of a Luftwaffe fighter pilot was 26, his RAF counterpart, 20. With each rapid victory of the German army, Gallant's fighter group moved to a new airfield to keep up with the advancing front and therefore moved closer to the French coast, closer to England. Every advance meant an increase in the amount of time a fighter could engage in combat over the English mainland. Barring a peace agreement between Churchill and Hitler, the next phase of the war would begin. In Gallant's view, the outcome was certain. England would be crushed. The first reply from Britain to Hitler's speech came an hour after its conclusion, in the form of a commentary broadcast by the BBC, without prior authorization by either Churchill or Foreign Secretary Halifax. The commentator, Sefton Delmer, did not mince words. "Let me tell you what we here in Britain think of this appeal to what you are pleased to call our reason and common sense," he said. "Herr Führer and Reich Chancellor, we hurl it right back into your evil-smelling teeth." William Shirer was present at the German radio centre in Berlin, getting ready to broadcast his own report on Hitler's speech, when he heard the BBC reply. The various officials present in the studio could not believe their ears, Shirer wrote. One shouted, "Can you make it out? Can you understand those British fools? To turn down peace now? They're crazy." Britain's official response came 3 days later, but not from Churchill. "I do not propose to say anything in reply to Herr Hitler's speech, not being on speaking terms with him, he quipped. Foreign Secretary Halifax gave the reply on Monday, July 22nd, at 9:15 p.m. His message was clear. We shall not stop fighting, he said, until freedom, for ourselves and others, is secure. Propaganda Minister Goebbels instructed the German press to describe Halifax's official rejection as a war crime. At his morning meeting on Wednesday, July 24th, Goebbels outlined how Germany's propaganda apparatus would now proceed. Mistrust must be sown of the plutocratic ruling caste, and fear must be instilled of what is about to befall. All this must be laid on as thick as possible. The ministry's array of secret transmitters, masquerading as English radio stations but based in Germany, were now to be deployed to arouse alarm and fear among the British people. They were to take pains to disguise their German origins, even to the point of starting broadcasts with criticism of the Nazi Party, and filled their reports with grisly details of air raid deaths and injuries, so that when the first air raids against England took place, the populace would be primed for panic. Goebbels also ordered broadcasts that outwardly would appear to be classes on how to prepare for an air raid, but whose precise details were, in fact, meant to further terrorise British listeners. Seeking also to leverage British anxiety about invasion, Goebbels directed his transmitters to report, falsely, that the German army had found 100,000 British uniforms left behind at Dunkirk. At the right moment, the secret transmitters should then put out the story that parachutists have been dropped over Britain wearing these uniforms. By now, nearly all of Germany's fighter aircraft were massed at airfields in France along the Channel coast, including those of Adolf Galland's group, based at an airfield near Calais, just 100 air miles from central London. Chapter 25. The Prof's Surprise. Throughout Whitehall, the Prof, Frederick Lindemann, was fast gaining a reputation for being difficult. Brilliant, yes, but time and again he demonstrated an annoying proclivity for disrupting the working lives of others. On the night of Saturday, July 27th, Lindemann joined the Churchills for dinner at Chequers. As usual, the house was full of guests. Beaverbrook, Ismay, Churchill's daughter Diana and her husband, Duncan Sands, as well as various senior military officials, including Field Marshal Sir John Dill, Chief of the Imperial General Staff, and Sir James Marshal Cornwall, Commander of the British Army's Third Corps, most having come to dine and sleep. Mary Churchill was absent still, summering at the Norfolk estate of her cousin and friend Judy Montague. As always, the guests dressed for dinner, the women in gowns, the men in dinner jackets. Lindemann wore his usual morning coat and striped pants. Churchill was in high spirits, bubbling over with enthusiasm and infectious gaiety, wrote General Marshal Cornwall later. The general sat between Churchill and the Prof, with Field Marshal Dill directly across the table. Churchill liked to refer to Dill by the four-letter abbreviation of his title, SIGS. Champagne arrived, and immediately Churchill began quizzing Marshal Cornwall about the status of the two divisions under his command, which had escaped Dunkirk with little or no equipment. The general got off to a good start by telling Churchill that his first task had been to emphasize taking the offensive. Until now, he explained, his corps had been obsessed with defensive tactical ideas, the main object of everyone being to get behind an anti-tank obstacle. The Corps' new slogan, he said, was hitting, not sitting. Churchill was delighted. Splendid, he told the general. That's the spirit I want to see. Marshal Cornwall's apparent confidence prompted Churchill to ask another question. I assume, then, that your corps is now ready to take the field. Very far from it, sir, Marshal Cornwall said. Our re-equipment is not nearly complete, and when it is, we shall require another month or two of intensive training. Churchill's mood deflated. With a disbelieving glower, he reached into a pocket of his dinner jacket and withdrew a bundle of papers, the Prof's latest state of readiness charts. These were statistical compilations that Lindemann's office had begun producing earlier that month, at Churchill's request. They purported to show the state of readiness of every army division on a weekly basis, down to the level of rifles, machine guns and mortars. These compilations had become a source of irritation around Whitehall. We are aware, said one senior War Office official, that figures have in the past been used by Professor Lindemann's department in such a way as possibly to convey a wrong impression to the Prime Minister. Churchill opened the sheaf of statistics he had just withdrawn from his pocket and pointedly asked General Marshal Cornwall, "What are your two divisions?" "The 53rd Welsh and the 2nd London," the General replied. With one pudgy finger, Churchill grabbed among the entries in the Prof's tables until he found the two divisions. "There you are," Churchill said. 100% complete in personnel, rifles and mortars. 50% complete in field artillery, anti-tank rifles and machine guns." This startled the General. His divisions were anything but ready. "I beg your pardon, sir," he said. "That state may refer to the weapons which the ordnance depots are preparing to issue to my units, but they have not yet reached the troops in anything like those quantities." Churchill glared, and almost speechless with rage, as Marshal Cornwall put it, threw the papers across the table toward General Dill, chief of the Imperial General Staff. "Siggs," he said, "have those papers checked and returned to me tomorrow." For a moment all conversation ceased. "A diversion seemed called for," Marshal Cornwall wrote, and Churchill supplied it. He leaned toward the Prof, who was seated on Marshal Cornwall's other side. "Prof," he bellowed, "what have you got to tell me today?" For all Lindemann's apparent self-effacement, his pale appearance, quiet voice, and less than ebullient personality, he in fact liked being the centre of attention, and understood that by leveraging his apparent blandness, he could amplify the impact of the things he said and did. Now, at the table, Lindemann reached slowly into the pocket of his tailcoat, and, with a magician's flourish, pulled out a hand grenade of a type known colloquially as a Mills bomb, the classic grooved pineapple, with a levered handle and circular metal pull ring. This got everyone's attention. A look of concern spread around the table. Churchill shouted, "What's that you've got, Prof? What's that?" "This," Lindemann said, "is the inefficient Mills bomb issued to the British infantry. It was constructed of a dozen different parts," he explained, "each of which had to be crafted by a different machining process. Now, I have designed an improved grenade which has fewer machined parts and contains a 50% greater bursting charge." Churchill, always willing to embrace a new gadget or weapon, exclaimed, "Splendid, Prof. Splendid. That's what I like to hear." To General Dill, he said, "Siggs, have the Mills bomb scrapped at once and the Lindemann grenade introduced." Dill, according to Marshal Cornwall, was completely taken aback. The army had already contracted with manufacturers in England and America to build millions of the old grenade. But the Prime Minister would not listen, Marshal Cornwall said. A more level appraisal appears to have taken place at some point after the dinner, however, for the Mills bomb would remain in service, with various modifications, for another 3 decades. Whether the grenade that Lindemann flourished at dinner was a live bomb or not is a detail lost to history. Now Churchill pointed toward Beaverbrook, at the other side of the table.
"Max," he cried, "what have you been up to?"
In gentle mockery of the Prof and his numbers, Beaverbrook answered, "Prime Minister, give me 5 minutes and you will have the latest figures." He left the table and walked to a telephone at one end of the room. He returned a few moments later with a grin on his face that telegraphed mischief afoot. He said, "Prime Minister, in the last 48 hours we have increased our production of hurricanes by 50%. Chapter 26 White Gloves at Dawn. In his communications with President Roosevelt, Churchill found himself compelled to walk a very fine line. On the one hand, he had to make the President understand how urgent things had become. At the same time, he had to avoid making Britain's situation seem so bleak that Roosevelt might balk at providing significant aid for fear that, if England fell, the American supplies would be abandoned or destroyed, or worse, captured and turned eventually against American forces. The thousands of trucks, guns, and supplies abandoned at Dunkirk provided vivid testament to the high material costs of defeat. It was crucial now, Churchill knew, to shore up Britain's own confidence in ultimate victory and, above all, to quash any manifestations of official pessimism. This was especially important with regard to the ultimate disposition of the British fleet. with concerns about the French navy, in large part assuaged by the action at Mers el-Kébir, the United States wanted assurances that Britain would never surrender its own fleet to Germany, and considered hinging the donation of destroyers on an agreement that if defeat became inevitable, the British fleet would be placed under American control. Churchill abhorred the idea of using the fleet as a negotiating lever to secure the destroyers. In an August 7th cable, he urged his ambassador to America, Lord Lothian, to resist any discussion of even the possibility of such an agreement, fearing that it would send a defeatist message, the effect of which would be disastrous. A week later, Churchill struck the same theme in a meeting of his war cabinet, whose minutes record him as saying, "Nothing must now be said which would disturb morale or lead people to think that we should not fight it out here." In his cable to Lothian, however, he did allow that if the United States entered the war and became a full-fledged ally, the fleet would be open to whatever strategic disposition both sides deemed necessary for the final effectual defeat of the enemy. He saw a positive side to America's interest in the fleet, for it indicated that Roosevelt took seriously his previous warnings that a defeated Britain under Nazi control would pose a grave danger to America. As Churchill saw it, a little apprehension on America's part was to be welcomed. He told Lothian, "We have no intention of relieving the United States from any well-grounded anxieties on this point." Churchill also understood that American public opinion was split sharply between isolationists, who wanted nothing to do with the war, and those who believed war would come eventually, and that the longer America waited, the more costly intervention would be. But it also galled Churchill that Roosevelt was unable to see forward with that same dreadful clarity. Churchill had first asked about the possible loan of 50 obsolete destroyers back in May, and he had repeated his request on June 11th, stating, "The next 6 months are vital." But America still had not delivered the ships. Churchill knew that Roosevelt was an ally in spirit, but like many of his fellow countrymen, Churchill imagined the president to have more power than he did. Why could Roosevelt not do more to translate that spiritual allegiance into material aid, even direct intervention? Roosevelt, however, faced a political landscape of daunting complexity. Congress was already riven with countervailing passions, raised by the introduction of a bill calling for national conscription, the first peacetime draft in history. Roosevelt saw it as a necessity. When the war in Europe began, the U.S. Army had only 174,000 men, equipped with obsolete weapons, including Springfield rifles that dated to 1903. In May, a military maneuver involving 70,000 soldiers conducted in the South had revealed the sorry state of this army to fight a war, especially a war against a juggernaut like Hitler's heavily mechanized army. As Time magazine put it, "Against Europe's total war, the U.S. Army looked like a few nice boys with BB guns." To send Britain the 50 destroyers would, Roosevelt believed, require congressional approval, owing to a clause in the Federal Munitions Program of 1940, which held that before the United States could ship military supplies abroad, Congress first had to confirm that the supplies were not needed by America's own armed forces. Given the passions already aroused by the debate over conscription, Roosevelt believed such approval to be unlikely, even though the ships were, in fact, obsolete, so much so that earlier in the year, Congress had considered scrapping them. But the Navy had intervened, arguing that these very destroyers were, in fact, vital assets. What further confounded things was that 1940 was a presidential election year, and Roosevelt had decided to run for an unprecedented third term. He had accepted the Democratic nomination on July 18th at the party's convention in Chicago. He was sympathetic to Britain's plight and favored doing all he could to send aid, but he also understood that many in America were deeply opposed to joining the war. For the time being, at least, both he and his Republican opponent, Wendell Willkie, were treating the issue with circumspection. For Churchill, however, the war grew ever more threatening. The German Navy was on the verge of launching two brand new battleships, the Bismarck and the Tirpitz, both of which Churchill identified as targets of supreme consequence. Air and U-boat attacks against inbound merchant convoys and British destroyers were growing increasingly effective, destroyers being, as Churchill cabled Roosevelt, frighteningly vulnerable to air bombing. The American destroyers would be vital now, not just for helping protect convoys, but for guarding home waters, and perhaps buying time as England struggled to organize and re-equip its forces evacuated from Dunkirk. But Roosevelt remained maddeningly aloof. Churchill would never stoop to pleading, although at the end of July he came close. In a cable to Roosevelt on Wednesday, July 31st, he wrote that the need for the destroyers, as well as other supplies, was now most urgent. This was a crucial moment, he warned. The mere presence or absence of the American ships, this minor and easily remediable factor, could decide the whole fate of the war. In his draft telegram, he pressed the point in a tone he had not previously used with the president. I cannot understand why, with the position as it is, you do not send me at least 50 or 60 of your oldest destroyers. But he omitted this phrase from the final cable. Churchill promised to outfit the ships immediately with submarine-finding sonar and to deploy them against U-boats in the western approaches, the shipping lanes that converged on the western entrance to the channel. The destroyers also would be essential in helping repulse the expected amphibious invasion. Mr. President, with great respect, I must tell you that in the long history of the world, this is a thing to do now. In his own later retelling, Churchill italicized now. Roosevelt did understand the urgency of Churchill's demand for destroyers, and on Friday, August 2nd, he convened a cabinet meeting to find a way to give England the ships without running afoul of American neutrality laws. In the course of the meeting, his Secretary of the Navy, Frank Knox, proposed an idea. Why not structure the transfer as a trade, in which America would give Britain the destroyers in return for access to British naval bases on various islands in the Atlantic, including Newfoundland and Bermuda? The law allowed the transfer of war materials if the result was an improvement in America's security. The gain of strategic bases in return for obsolete destroyers seemed to meet the requirement. Roosevelt and the cabinet approved, but, given the political climate, agreed that the exchange would still need the approval of Congress. Roosevelt asked a friendly senator, Claude Pepper, to introduce a bill authorizing the trade. For it to have any chance at all, it would need the endorsement of the Republican Party. But with so many Americans adamantly opposed to going to war and an election on the horizon, this proved impossible to attain. Pepper told Roosevelt the bill had no chance of passing. On that Friday, Churchill made Beaverbrook a full member of his war cabinet and, soon afterward, of his defense committee. Beaverbrook joined with reluctance. He loathed committees of any kind, at any level. A sign in his office shouted, "Committees take the punch out of war." Meetings were the last thing he needed. "I was driven all through the day at the aircraft ministry with the need for more production," he wrote in a private recollection. "I was harassed by the fear that her air force would go short of supplies. I was required to attend innumerable cabinet meetings, and if I absented myself, the Prime Minister would send for me." Churchill would summon him for meetings of the Defense Committee that would extend late into the night, after which Churchill would retain him and continue the discussion in his sitting room. "The burden was too heavy," Beaverbrook wrote, and Churchill, he noted, had an unfair advantage: his naps. On Sunday, August 4th, Churchill's son Randolph returned home to 10 Downing Street on leave from his army unit, the 4th Queen's Own Hussars, looking lean and fit in his uniform. The first night began on a happy note, with a joyful dinner at 10 Downing with Pamela, Clementine and Churchill, everyone in good spirits. After dinner, Churchill went back to work, and Clementine retired to her bedroom, where she spent many evenings alone. She disliked many of her husband's friends and colleagues, and much preferred dining in her room, an austere chamber with a single bed and a sink. Churchill, meanwhile, held or attended dinners as often as 5 nights a week. Despite this being Randolph's first night home in a while, he set off after dinner for the Savoy Hotel by himself. He planned to meet a friend, H.R. Knickerbocker, an American journalist, and assured Pamela that he would be gone only a short time. The two men drank together until the hotel bar closed, then went to Knickerbocker's room, where they polished off at least one bottle of brandy. Randolph returned to 10 Downing at 6:10 the next morning, his arrival witnessed by Churchill's security man, Inspector Thompson. Randolph stumbled from his car and made his way to Pamela's room, too drunk even to change into his nightclothes. Thompson inspected the car. For Pamela, Randolph's drunkenness and disheveled appearance were mortifying enough, but about an hour later, around 7:30 a.m., a maid knocked on Pamela's door and presented a note from Clementine, demanding to see her immediately. Clementine was livid. When angry, she had a habit of donning white gloves. She was wearing them now. "Where was Randolph last night?" she asked. "Do you have any idea what has happened?" Pamela knew, of course, that her husband had come home drunk, but judging by Clementine's demeanor, there was more to come. At this point, Pamela began to cry. Clementine told her that Inspector Thompson, upon checking Randolph's car, had discovered a collection of secret military maps inside, accessible to any passerby. A serious violation of security protocols. "What is going on?" Clementine asked. Pamela confronted Randolph, who offered fervent apologies. Shamefaced, he told her all that had occurred, and then told his father. Randolph apologized and promised to give up drinking. Clementine's fury remained unabated. She banished Randolph from 10 Downing, forcing him to take up temporary residence at his men's club, White's, a 17th-century haven for many a disgraced husband, especially those, like Randolph, who were inclined toward gambling. His promise to quit drinking proved to be one of many pledges he could not keep.